broken.
At the same time, many of many people who had grown up in these mountains were interested in moving out along a road somewhere and getting a new home built, or moving into a mobile home, and getting out of the deep hollows. And I remember an old man in Braxton County one time. I stopped to ask him directions, and we got to talking. And he said, the thing I can't understand is these hippies that are moving in here. And they're moving way back in the mountains, and they're buying up the old home places that the rest of us left. And we've all moved out here on the road, live along the road here where it's civilized and where you can go in amongst people. And they're back there doing God knows what, back in the thickets. Well, what they were doing back in the thickets was trying to live like this man had been raised to live, or maybe his parents. And he was, of course, trying to get away from that. So in many cases, it was like ships passing in the night. But it was fascinating. And I was also in Kentucky, was involved with the Appalachian Volunteer Program, which actually brought young people, not just young people, there were people of all ages. They were primarily younger people in their 20s, early 30s, into the mountains as Vista volunteers and Appalachian volunteers, who came from very, very different communities than the ones that we were working in there. And some of them stayed on, you know, let their hair grow long, and turned up their nose at the government and at the goals that their parents, I guess many of them had hoped that they would have, and didn't go back to law school and didn't go back to medical school, and instead, you know, bought 40 acres of land and let their hair grow long and having babies and raising peaches, you know, like the song says. so it was an interesting juxtaposition, and there was a lot of interchange, mostly positive, I'm convinced later. I mean, when you evaluate things like the Vista program and the Appalachian Volunteer program, did they put more money in the pockets of local people? Did they help create more jobs? Did they do? No, a lot of those things they didn't do. They were not, the volunteers themselves were not highly skilled people like the Peace Corps likes to find. Who could. In Kentucky, they call them the visitors. And in many cases, that's what they were. They would come for a year and live in somebody's home, and sometimes they'd get in some difficulty, and the community would have to come together and figure out what to do with this strange person who was there. But they also started daycare centers. They started tutorial programs. They worked a lot with the kids. And I think it was a good thing overall, in retrospect. At the time, I was a little jaded about it, but in retrospect, I think it was good. And I think the hippie homesteading movement was good overall, and with some problems. It was, and the festivals, as you said, were a time for all of that to come together. I remember a festival at High Knob. Jack Wright was another one of these second comers, you know, down in Wise County. He's about the age of the Morris brothers. Great singer, Vietnam veteran, festival generator, you know, still interested in playing music. He was involved at Apple Shop and made films about the Carter family, and Jack Wright is a legend already. And he and, I guess, Rich Kirby and some other people were organizing a festival up at High Knob near Norton, Virginia, way high on top of a mountain. Beautiful, flat place up there. Prettiest place for a festival I think I ever saw. And By the second night, the word had gotten out around Wise County and some of the other nearby counties that this festival was going on, and all kind of people showed up. And by midnight of the second night, there was a group of people over here that were all drinking alcohol, and it, you know, had come in pickup trucks, and a lot of them were underemployed or unemployed coal miners. And they were raising hell. They were drinking, and they were raising hell. There were some fights, and over here was the hippie element, you know, moving to the tune of an entirely different drum. And they were huddled up under blankets together on the ground, listening to the music and looking at the stars and watching the world go by. And I've never seen such a dramatic example of. The difference between alcohol and other stimulants, you know, in a crowd. It was a kind of a metaphor almost for the ways in which those people came together at different times in different settings. And those were great years. I miss them.
One of the things that I've thought about with the Morse family festivals is that, and I don't know if this is true or not, but it seems to me that a lot of those older musicians, you know, Ira Mullins, Lee Triplett, the whole group, would have never, their music would have never been heard, or they would have never been recognized for what they were, had it not been for Dave and John, and taking them to places like Brandywine Festival and featuring them there. And you know, had they not done this at that particular time, that those individuals and their contributions would have been lost to the general public anyway. I mean, there would have been some individuals who knew of them. But do you think that's true?
Oh, without a question. Yeah, okay. I think that's true. Yeah, that there were. I wonder if Don West was the first in Southern West Virginia. Certainly, the Patrick Gaynor had this concept, I guess, long before anybody else. And by 1950, even before, I think, but certainly by 1950, he was staging these festivals at Glenville. And Glenville never lost that feeling of a truly old-time festival where and you could go to Glenville until quite recently. So many of these people have left us now, you know, there's just a handful of them really right. Still around. But 10 years ago, you could go to Glenville and you would see people you wouldn't see anywhere else at any other festival. Of course, that was true of the couple of years at Ivydale, too. There were people there you wouldn't see anywhere else. But so the Glenville thing was going along, and then in that section, and then Don West got the idea started down in Southern West Virginia, and then the Morris brothers kind of in between followed right on the heels of Don West. I don't know if they would say that the Don West Festival was the model they were using or not, but that's how I would tell it.
Okay.
Don West came a year before them, I think, and I think they were very smitten by Don at first. I don't know how well they got along over time, but I think they were very influenced by what Don was doing.
I know they were performers at his festival.
Yeah. So I don't know how they would remember it, but that's how I remember it.
Yeah.
And then the Morris brothers, and then the Department of Culture and History. With Tom Scriven, they kind of picked up the ball for a while, and they got that Vandalia thing going over there, and then up in, more in the center part of the state, Augusta. Since 1973, Augusta has been featuring old timers. The original Hammondses were all featured at Augusta one time or another. And people were struck dumb by them. I mean, what you say is true, that this that this was a way in which the general public became much more aware of it, and I think it's I think it helped to create a kind of a mystique about West Virginia, that West Virginia deserves to have recognized that it's just not like other places, and that then the music is very largely what makes it distinctive. There's a whole body of fiddle tunes in central and southern West Virginia you don't hear anywhere else, and that may be true for Kentucky too, and Tennessee. It may be true for, in a sense, for anywhere. But these West Virginia tunes are just amazing. Lee Triplett and then Harvey Sampson and Phoebe Parsons and those people. Nobody else like them.
And I think one of the things that Jerry Milnes pointed out, that he felt that the festival was unique to him anyway at that time in his experience. He'd never been somewhere where the performers were the audience, and the audience were the performers. You know, it was that kind of thing, that there was no divisions between performers and the audience. There were no stars. Everybody was welcome, and everybody was, you know. More than likely than not, he said, David would be going through the crowd saying, "We need a band in 10 minutes. Can you do it?" You know, mm-hmm. you know that, mm-hmm. and that kind of.
Or somebody jump up there and play with Lee.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a natural. It had a very natural flow to it, and it set a tone for that dynamic you're talking about. It's so hard to maintain it, and that's what Glenville's done that a lot of other places, I think including Augusta, have not done. Kept that kind of feeling where you could just walk up and talk to a person who'd been singing and not feel like they were better than you or any different than you, really. With Augusta, you get a real, it's a real stagey place, you know. But that's what people want, too. They want to see that. But there'll never be another Ivydale. There'll never be another Pipestem, the way those things were originally. And Glenville, as long as Phoebe keeps coming, I guess, Glenville will have that kind of spirit too.
Yeah, well, it hasn't really changed too much, I don't think, in the last few years, other than the fact that it's actually gotten a little smaller, which is kind of nice as far as the attendance and that sort of thing. Still, a lot of good musicians come, and they've kept the original spirit of the thing. Jenny Hawker is now in charge of it since Max Samples left.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it seems like they're still just doing everything right.
Well, we have, with Jenny, you know, we have another example of someone out of that generation. And her daughter is an amazing singer, too.
Yes, I've never heard her daughter.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. So you have an unbroken tradition of that singing in that family right up into the present. And that's what we love to see. That's what we come together to celebrate, is this unbroken tradition, which somehow has accommodated all this new energy from the back to the landers, the hippies, the revivalists, whatever you want to call them, who recognized in the music a kind of integrity and a kind of irresistible melodic flow that they wanted to do themselves, and with teaching places like Augusta, and there's no limit to the kind of exposure that if you've got the if you've got the plastic in your pocket, the kind of exposure you can get. Jerry Milnes' apprenticeship program.
Yeah.
You know. But it's all, well, I guess we're all trying to beat the tube somehow, and that's an uphill struggle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because for every one that we can excite about a traditional handmade kind of culture, the TV has sucked up another 10,000 who think their way. Mm. So it's an uphill struggle, but I think it's still worth it. What else are you going to do these days?
That's true.
If you don't fight that fight, what else are you going to do? I don't know.
I don't know if you have any additional thoughts or anything, or if you think that's about it, that's fine too, Michael. I appreciate you doing this.
Well, I'm appalled at my lack of memory of specific details, but you know, you're working on so many different things all the time. Mm-hmm. That's really, it all sort of runs together after a while.
Well, and I'm sure that you were doing a lot of things at that time too. There were other festivals you were probably going to and mm-hmm. involved with, and you know, so it's understandable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the reason my memories are so vivid is because that was my first time to ever go to something like that, and I also made some. I had a little tape recorder. I made tapes of it and took notes on, you know, who was playing and what song, that kind of thing. Tried to document as much as I could because I was just so excited about it at that time.
And so you have tapes of those, performances?
I have tapes that I made myself. Yeah, just sitting out in the audience, uh-huh. And also a couple. People would just come by where we were staying, and I taped a few people like that too.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so that's why I remember these things.
Well, what do you think it would take to get something like that going in Wheeling?
Yeah. Certainly a possibility. It seems like everything's gotten so much more complicated. When it comes to permits and health regulations and all the little details that you would have to attend to accommodate a public group of any size, you know, that in a place to have it that would, you know, be conducive to that sort of thing. I guess I don't know if you can recreate something like Ivydale and have it be as good. You know, I mean, I'm sure you could do a festival. I think there's a certain amount of interest in it, you know. But I don't know. In some ways, I almost would hate to try to. So you just couldn't do it as well. it wouldn't be the same.
Now those things were so spontaneous. I mean, they were like little Woodstocks in their own way, because everybody just came.
As I recall, advertising was very limited.
Oh,
it was more word of mouth
word
than
of
anything.
Mouth.
In fact, I took a group of people. I guess they had always had it on Labor Day weekend. Does that sound right to you?
I think. Yeah.
And they quit having the festival, and I didn't know any better. So I had a carload of people drive down on the Labor Day weekend after they quit having the festival and came and found the festival site, and of course it was empty. And so we had to, we drove north and eventually found another festival that Glenn Smith was putting on that weekend up in Elizabeth. But you know, it's the kind of thing that I just always heard by word of mouth that it was happening, and I didn't get the message that it wasn't happening that year. So. Yeah. Mm-hmm.